Hi. Welcome to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy Faye Solomon, your host and producer. Coming to you today on April 9th. We're starting at 10:25 a.m. if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're broadcasting live out of Studio132.com with BZ Lewis, who is a six-time Emmy-winning sound engineer and excellent musician. I'm delighted to have Dr. Randall Cohn in the office, in the studio today.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So, and am I pronouncing your name correctly?
The last name is Cohn. Yeah.
Cohn. Yeah. Okay, Dr. Randall Cohn is a Dutch neuroscientist, a neuroengineer, a preeminent theorist, founder, and developer, and he'll be discussing whole brain emulation and the state of science and technology for neuroprosthesis. So the Global Product Management Talk is a top 10 business podcast in the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can find us at www.blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. That is our Twitter handle if you'd like to follow us at PRODMGMTTALK, and that is the hashtag we use, PRODMGMTTALK. You can follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, and you will get pinged with upcoming episodes as well as the archives of over 100 episodes of the past couple years where I've been talking with thought leaders, practitioners, entrepreneurs, and experts discussing vital issues affecting professionals passionate about product excellence, product management, startups, marketing, innovation, and methodology. Thank you to our sponsor, our preeminent sponsor, the AIPMM. You can find them at AIPMM. They're the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. They were founded in 1998, and they promote worldwide excellence in product management education via certifications, professional networking opportunities, and they provide corporate members an assurance that their product professionals are operating at peak performance. Go to www.aipmm.com to find out more information. I will also be moderating their webinar this Friday, where we are talking with Yammer, product manager and business analyst, about data-driven product management and a case study of an application at Yammer. We're broadcasting live at Studio132.com. Thank you to Blaine Sally for the music. And check out StartupProduct.com, the movement for product excellence, at Startup Product, bringing you educational opportunities and community to network and meet other people to forward your product, career, startup, and business. Check out the Webcast Digest for daily curated educational webcasts, webinars, and free online events for your continuous learning. Go to webcastdigest.com. Also, our speaker a couple of weeks ago, Chad McAllister, has made his ebook, Turning Ideas into Market-Winning Products. It's available for free. If you go to Startup Product, it's a short-term promotion. You can give a review of the book and get the book for free. Just to shout out to our new members and to the Startup Product Silicon Valley community. We had a great meeting last night at Hanhe Investments in San Jose, where we were talking about the Lean Canvas and how to actually apply it using the Lean Stack. So thanks to everyone who attended, and again, go to startupproduct.com under communities to find upcoming meetups and upcoming events. So today, I am delighted to have Dr. Randall Cohn, Cohn, in the studio with me, and let me tell you a bit about him. And I'm sorry, I'm shuffling here. I'm off my mark today. So, and I apologize. Okay. So, Dr. Randall Kuna has been focusing on the functional reconstruction of neurotissue since 1994. He introduced a multidisciplinary field of whole brain emulation and is lead curator of the scientific roadmap with which its technological development is promoted. He is CEO and founder of the Science Foundation, CarbonCopies.org, and neural interfaces company Neuralink Co. He is science director of the 2045 initiative and advises several neurotechnology companies and organizations. In previous roles, he was director of analysis at Silicon Valley nanotechnology company Halcyon Molecular, and he was director of the Department of Neuroengineering at Technalia, the third largest private research organization in Europe. He was a research professor at Boston University's Center for Memory and Brain, and he earned his PhD studying memory mechanisms at McGill University after obtaining a master's in science in electrical engineering with a specialization in information theory at Delft University of Technology. His publications, presentations, and interviews are available at randallkoenen.com, RANDALKOENE.com, and you can follow him on Twitter, @RANDALKOENE. And by the way, I'm Cindy Faye Solomon. I'm a certified product manager and certified product marketing manager and a product management evangelist. You can follow me at Cindy F. Solomon on Twitter. Okay, so thank you. Doctor, how should I refer to you?
Just say Randall, please.
Randall,
thanks for having me here.
That's the easiest. Thanks for coming in. And so we met last month at a humanist conference, at a futurist conference in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there because of my colleague Scott Jackish, who was speaking, and I attend the Futurist Meetup here in the East Bay that Scott has been leading. And Scott is actually on the show next week.
Oh, interesting.
So I must say that that was, I want to say mind-boggling. That's not quite a technical term. So that was quite eye-opening an experience for me to be there. And I actually mm-hmm. came with my daughter, who's interested in bioengineering. And of all the speakers, I found you to be the most level-headed and most realistically, you were talking about things that are actually, it wasn't just theory.
I try to be very concrete, yeah.
Yes, you were very concrete, and you made the concepts graspable.
Thank you.
So, and that's one of the things I like to do on the show is to provide some context for our listeners who are entrepreneurs, product people, passionate about product excellence and all the ramifications, and certainly interested in not only what is currently available and possible, but where we're heading. And that's very important for people to be thinking about the future, because the platforms, we need to be creating platforms that enable us to create products. And currently I see so much that happens in software. We get invested in a platform that's limiting.
Yes. Yeah, that's true.
So, so is there anything you want to add to that to give us some context for how you got into what you're doing? And
yeah, sure. I'll give some context. I suppose there are many different reasons why someone gets involved in what they do, and it starts with a very personal one, which is just, I was enjoyed doing all sorts of things. I was a very creative person. I like to write. I like to read and listen to music, make music, things like that. And once you start doing that, because you're engaging your creative capabilities, you realize that there are constantly limitations you're bumping up against. And that led me to think about, where does it all come from? And obviously then I start thinking about the brain, about the mind, about who we are. And I was still very young when this was going on, about 13 or so. And that set me on a path towards trying to do something about that, where I thought it's useful to try to improve who we are. Now, when you look around us and you see all the gadgets that we have, These are already attempts that we have to improve who we are. This is what really makes us human, right? Humans are constantly extending themselves, augmenting themselves in one way or another. But we really haven't done very much about directly augmenting that which is going on between our ears. That's where still everything that comes to us, all the information that we're processing, it has to be processed in the same way that it's been processed for millions of years. And that leads to a few limitations. I mean, we have imperfect memory. We can't really remember with the kind of precision that a database can. We can't really choose as clearly and easily what we want to remember, which is why I constantly forget names, even though it's essential in my profession to understand and remember who everybody is. Those sort of things, and much more, of course, but that's just getting to the very simple, basic things that show you directly that we have all sorts of limitations. So that made me very interested in what's going on in the brain, and then I extended that thought towards, well, what does this really mean for us as a species? Where are we right now? Why are we here? And when you think about it, and you think in terms of what's been going on for millions of years and the selection procedure that's going on, well, you know, natural selection works by picking whatever happens to survive. So there are a lot of losers. There are a lot of things that don't survive, a lot of species that don't make it. We made it into this particular niche here, so we're well suited for it. We're able to survive here with all the stuff that we make. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're well suited for every other challenge that comes along. And again, that same procedure is going to take place. It's selection. It doesn't mean that you get evolved to the next level. It means that all the things that are there get compared and selected out, and only the ones that are winners stay. So it would be better not to be stuck with that procedure. It'd be better if we as a species are able to adapt to all kinds of challenges that come along. So making ourselves able to adapt is, to me, the kind of the higher calling that comes to it beyond that personal thing. So that's what got me started in this area. And because all of it comes back to what are our minds capable of, what is the brain capable of, it comes down to understanding what's in there and being able to access it, being able to extend what's going on in the brain. And the biggest problem that we have there is that, unlike a computer, you can't simply read what's inside the brain. It's not built for access. And that's where neuroprosthesis comes in, building of replacement parts that are completely accessible, which, when you extend it to the entire brain, is this concept of whole brain emulation. So can you run everything that's going on inside the brain, everything that's making our mind emerge from that, on another substrate?
And so what's exciting to me is I remember as a child thinking how inefficient it is that every new baby has to learn knowledge anew. Why can't we just stand on the shoulders of our parents and take the best learning and input it into a baby so the next generation can go further without having the trials and tribulations, you know, without having to learn? Why can't, you know, we're not advancing. It's almost like every generation starts over. And also, if we could sort out, I only want the best stuff. I don't want to take all the things that didn't work for my parents.
Yeah. A better understanding of which things work and which don't is definitely one of those aspects that I want to discover. Of course, the learning aspect, this is something where we already made a huge jump being able to communicate with one another and tell each other stories and deliver educational messages to one another, from being a species before that where everyone would have to go out and experience things by themselves to learn something. So that was already one step towards more rapid learning. And I'm sure that can be sped up further, even though it's a very complicated process, because when people think about the future and they think about how you could just say, put in a chip or run some kind of disk that has the data on, you know, maybe if you've seen The Matrix, that movie, we saw how Neo learns how to do martial arts by just kind of downloading it into his brain. That's a really complicated procedure, because the reason we can communicate with one another and the reason why we understand what someone's saying or writing is because we all share the same external world. We share one environment that our eyes have to be able to see and our ears have to be able to hear. But then, once it gets past that, inside our minds, even though they are built according to a similar structure, the precise individual connections in there, the way that everything gets laid out, is different from person to person. So if you want to take martial arts, or say, French or something like that, and just implant it in another person's brain, where are the things supposed to connect? How does it all work? You need to really understand that other person's brain in order to make the conversion from this is how it was learned in person A, and this is how it's going to be put into person B. So that kind of super fast learning, while terribly desirable, is also really complicated.
I'm thinking of APIs. It's kind of similar. We want to take a brain API
yeah.
and plant
but it. But it's kind of like having a program that was written for a Windows computer and wanting to stuff it into a Macintosh or something like
yep.
that.
Yes, the different operating systems. So you gave me a quote about, Kurzweil's exponential curves about how quickly we're advancing in technology. But, Kurzweil also is a founder of the Singularity Institute, and where I differ from Kurzweil's thinking is he wants to essentially, I think he's been motivated by taking his father's, who has passed away, and uploading his father's brain or the information knowledge. And so how similar, how aligned are you with Kurzweil's really out there in the Singularity Institute's, focus?
Well, I guess we share some ideas. So, for example, he believes that a human mind can exist in a different machine and a different kind of mechanism than what our biological brain is, and I believe that as well. So we share that. I also think that we are approaching a place where we can build machines that are soon going to be as capable or as intelligent as humans are, and by soon, I mean decades, but, somewhere along the line there. I think that we differ a little bit in terms of the details and looking at exactly how something could be done, what is possible. So, for instance, he wants his father to be recreated from the data that he's collected about him. But what he does not have from his father, of course, is he doesn't have an entire brain scan with synaptic records and all sorts of things like that. So he can't just take his father's brain and use that to create another copy of how his father worked. Instead, he has to take all kinds of circumstantial evidence about his father, the way his father appeared to him, which means he can perhaps make a good artificial intelligence simulacrum that may speak to him in a way that he recognizes as his father. But of course, that won't in any way assure him that this entity also feels from within itself like his father would feel. The subjective part may be entirely missing because that wasn't apparent in the data he's collected. That doesn't mean that it's not a good idea. I mean, if that's what he wants to achieve and if he's happy with that result, that can be perfectly fine. It's really all about what are your goals. I mean, you need to know what your goals are, what you're trying to achieve, then you can set criteria, and then you can try to get there. Which is another thing where I think my message is a little different from the one that Ray puts out there, because Ray talks a lot about the acceleration of progress along exponential curves in various different domains. And sure, some people debate that. They say that perhaps all of these curves are actually S-curves instead of exponentials, and that there's no guarantee that a particular curve will continue for a very long period of time, and where will we get to? You can debate all those things. That's fine. I don't have a problem with that, and I'm not going to debate it, because I think Ray's done a pretty good job of showing that some things have been progressing on exponential curves. But of course, saying that computation is going to continue to get faster doesn't necessarily tell you what you're going to do with that computation. In the same way, having exponential progress in society doesn't tell you where society is going to end up. Having a set of trends like that tells you very little about whether you're going to end up at any goals that you care about. So for me, there's always this difference between the trends, what's going on currently in the environment of science, technology, business, engineering, and where do you get to? Where does that all point? I like to think, in my work, I look at a lot of different labs. I look at a lot of companies and what they're doing. And I see what they're doing, and I think of it as something that's being directed currently by the interests of the individuals involved, by funding that's available to them and where that funding points to. So there's a societal interest that drives this funding very often. Then some interests that are perhaps within the 2 to 3 year time frame that are business interests where someone is investing into something. And they all lead that particular lab or person to point in some direction with what they're doing. I think of it as a field of vectors pointing in all kinds of little directions. Now, if you sum those together, you can see a few big trends emerge. You can see some particular directions that are getting a lot of emphasis. But if you want to reach your goals, you may need to adjust some of those vectors, which means you need to you need to address and invest in certain kinds of work that are going on. You can't stop people from doing what they want to do. That's just impossible, because people will do what they're interested in doing, and otherwise you're just swimming against the stream. But what you can do is you can emphasize certain areas. You can say, well, these vectors should be a little bit bigger. So let's help them along and show them why it's interesting, and maybe connect them with the right kind of funding, or get the right people together, make sure problem people are connected to solution people. And if you do that, then you can drive those vectors more towards the goals that you want to have.
And that's what product managers do in an ideal world, actually. Having that perspective in understanding what the intentions are, as opposed to just quantifying what the trends are. The other thing that you talked about that in your in 2045, you're involved with the 2045 initiative. What is that? It's very rare that I hear about roadmaps that are 30 years out.
Yeah, so it's more of an intentional roadmap than a forecast or prognosticated roadmap. So the 2045 initiative was founded by a man called Dmitry Itzkov. He's a Russian who made quite a lot of money as a media entrepreneur in Russia. And he also had a background, a spiritual background, actually, that for him meant that people should strive to something higher, something better, that when he was seeing people simply developing various new iPhone gadgets or whatever, for him that wasn't enough for an interesting human future. He felt that people should eventually focus on improving themselves. He has a Hindu Vedic spiritual connection there, which is maybe similar to most of the Eastern religions and Buddhism, that he likes to focus on self-improvement in a sense. And so he set about looking at how this should be done, and decided that a progress towards whole brain emulation, towards this kind of improvement that I was also talking about earlier, was a good idea. So his plan that he set out for the years until 2045 includes that. It includes how to change who we are in terms of what we can control, so externally controlling other machines and bodies and things like that using our minds, then a phase where you would be able to replace parts of your body as they age and eventually have an entirely artificial body if necessary, and then ultimately also transferring the brain into a different kind of substrate so that, say, you would be perfectly suited for living on the moon rather than living on the Earth if you wanted to be in a different environment. And then it goes beyond that, because he wants to focus on people becoming spiritually better. So he has his large plan there, and I felt that there was a lot of overlap between what he was doing and what I was interested in, so it made sense for us to partner up and work together. And he started funding what carboncopies.org was doing for the period of time where we were working towards a big congress that was going to happen in New York in June 15th, 16th of last year. And we managed to pull together both the people he was interested in talking about long-term progress in terms of political, spiritual, etc. aspects, as well as a team of neuroscientists, engineers, and scientists of other domains that well represented the roadmap that I had laid out. So I made sure that they represented all the different parts of that, and that I was able to then give a talk that could put it all together, and that we had agreed beforehand that they were in agreement with this idea of going towards whole brain emulation and how their work fit into it. So it was a good opportunity to do that. And the organization 2045 Initiative still exists, although it's, I believe, currently working on a larger social network that they're trying to put together around the idea of progressing towards all those steps. And as I said, it's more an attempt to assure that certain things happen until 2045, so to try to get it done by then, rather than a forecast or some kind of insight into what's really happening in the future. But, I mean, that's pretty obvious.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you. And so did they capture the videos of those talks?
Yes, and I believe they're all either already online or going to be online. I certainly know that mine is available. So if you go to carboncopies.org and you look for the 2045 Congress that happened there, it's indicated among the events that have occurred, then you'll find that there. You'll also find all of the transcripts from the various talks that were certainly all of the ones related to neuroscience. I think some transcripts are still missing and some talks are still missing because they haven't been transcribed yet, but most of the information is there yet.
Excellent. Great. So let's come back to what you came here to talk about.
Sure.
Which is Substrate Independent Minds. The acronym is SIM. So you talk about them and there's a video where you did an interview, and I've posted that with the materials. And so Substrate Independent Minds, Whole Brain Emulation, and Mind Uploading. Can you define what those terms mean and how they relate to each other?
Sure. Yeah. As I said earlier on, I like to be concrete, and so I try to also be very concrete about how we use our terminology, because terminology is often very vague and confusing in these fields. So what we did is, first of all, try to define the goal. What are we trying to achieve? And we chose the term substrate independent minds because it embodies what we hope to achieve, which is that you can run a mind, that the mind can function, be operational, be what we expect it to be, and provide the experience that you normally experience, but running on a different substrate. So not necessarily the biological brain, but it could be either some other biological construct or an electronic computer or some new kind of neuromorphic computer, various things that you could move this to, as long as it still produces the phenomenon of mind. And so we use the term substrate independent not to mean that there isn't any kind of substrate, but that it can move to many different types of substrates, just like you can have platform independent code. Then there are many different ways that people have imagined to get towards substrate independent minds, but the only one that is currently truly feasible, the only one that has had plenty of research going on and that really is anchored in neuroscience, is this concept of whole brain emulation, which means in order to create a substrate independent mind, you build an emulator for the mind. And when you build an emulator in software, you usually need to have something that emulates the hardware upon which the software runs. So you need those functions that are there, and then you need the software on top of that, which you're running on that emulated hardware. If you're doing this in a brain, it means that you need to get a lot of the anatomy and the physiology of the brain into functions that represent what that anatomy and those physiology components are, and then you can put the right parameters into it, which is basically the software, and run that. So that's an emulation of the brain. It's what happens when you build prosthetic parts for the brain. So we have cochlear implants, retinal implants, and a few other prosthetic replacements so far. Then finally, the term mind uploading, it's actually, we're just being nice here by incorporating a term that was already in use, even though that term is actually fairly vague and gets people confused a lot because people also use terms like downloading and sideloading and whatever.
It's a sci-fi term, isn't it?
It's kind of a sci-fi term. But since it's so ingrained, it's kind of in use everywhere, I think it's perfectly okay to apply it when you know what you're talking about. So you can, for example, say mind uploading via whole brain emulation to a substrate independent mind. That makes sense in terms of keeping these concepts, these terminologies concrete.
Great. Well, thank you. And so I want to give a shout out to our tweeters, David Sprogus, and our fan of the show, Gil Zilberfeld. Glad to have you back. So David actually has a question regarding Howard Gardner's multiple intelligences. And he wants to know if you're decomposing the brain emulation and if it's aligned with how Gardner describes multiple intelligences.
I'm afraid I'm not
so I think it's in a different domain. Yeah. So he's talking about emotional intelligence.
Uh-huh.
And he's not talking about the content of the brain as much as the experience of and the interaction of the applying intelligence to places in our interactions that have been beyond our intelligence.
So my background is in neuroscience, and so my understanding from everything I've seen so far is that the mind, including everything that we experience, and that includes our application of emotions as well as intelligence, is an emergent phenomenon of the brain. If the brain functions properly, all of those things emerge and work. And you can tell because when you have people with lesions where certain parts of the brain are damaged, then those things get really messed up. You can have, and it can lead to very specific kinds of defects even, where you just forget how to recognize faces. For example, there's Oliver Sacks' very famous book about that. So to me, things like emotional intelligence are all part of a properly functioning brain. If your brain works, then all of that stuff is intact. So if you emulate it correctly, all of the same things should emerge as well. If they don't, then you haven't done it properly. I mean, those are the target criteria for the project, basically.
So a few years ago, when I first came out to California, I actually had a brain spec done by Dr. Amen. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. So he actually was studying people who suffered from various ADD type of disorders. And he approached it from actually looking at how what lit up inside the brain to different types of stimuli. So that was very insightful for me to see. He explained, and you know, I have pictures of my brain.
Yeah.
It was very, very interesting because I was in denial about, certain things, how I made choices about things, but then I had concrete evidence of how my brain was actually patterned.
It was almost like it wasn't my choice. Which region was activating for your, as your choices were being made?
Yeah, so actually what happened is, according to, and this was over 10 years ago, and I'm sure it's advanced since, but when it appeared that I was calm, my brain was lighting up, as opposed to when I was activated, that my brain was calm. So that's a classic ADD type of scenario, which is why I do all these things to stay focused. So so thanks. So David Sprogus is saying emotional intelligence is only one of the many types of multiple intelligences that Howard Gardner, and I believe he's an academic in the social sciences. The theory is that each of the brain's areas specializes in these different types of processing. So you could imagine similar specialization in computer processes. So again, always wanting to look at cross-discipline collaboration. But again, you're approaching it from a technical area. So has anyone yet created brain emulation or an emulation of a part of the brain?
Yeah, so I started by mentioning a few types of, neuroprostheses, because a neural prosthesis is basically a small piece of brain emulation. It's when a little piece of the brain doesn't work as you want it to, or of some, peripheral part of the brain where you're receiving sensory input, and you want to create a prosthetic, just like you would create a prosthetic limb, that takes over that function. And we do have a few examples of those. Now, the most common ones, the ones that are actually in use, include cochlear implants and now beginning to appear retinal implant, which means things that help people hear and see when they've lost that function. Those are true prosthetics, brain prosthetics, because they actually do link up with the neural signaling that's required to be able to receive light or to be able to hear sound. But a much better example, because it's deeper in the brain and doesn't directly link up with signals we can already detect on the outside, such as light and sound, is the so-called hippocampal prosthetic that Ted Berger and his team have produced at USC in LA. They have a device that is called a neuromimetic chip, which has been programmed to contain a function, a so-called transfer function, that has learned to create the right kind of output mapping for every input that it receives in an area of the hippocampus, where if that area is damaged, this chip can take over the function of that particular piece. Now, the hippocampus is extremely important for humans and many other animals because it's the area where we're able to create new, what we call episodic memory. That's the memory of how events are occurring and in which order. So when we're sitting here and we're having this discussion, the fact that this discussion is happening at all and that we are now talking about brain prostheses and all of these things as they occur in that order, the hippocampus is essential for being able to remember that this happened now and then that and then that and then that. It creates little tags that point to all the areas in the brain where neurons were lighting up as these bits of the discussion were happening, and it remembers the order in which that goes on. When the hippocampus is broken, then you can't do that anymore, and every day you wake up and you haven't got any new memories of the previous day, so the long-term memories you stored before you had that defect in your brain would be the last ones that you have episodic memories of. Now, the chip that Berger created does successfully replace that function in rats and now also in primates. And in about 3 years, he's going to be testing it in humans. And he's also taken the same process that he used for this hippocampal prosthetic, and he started to use it in prefrontal cortex to correct the connections between two different layers of the cortex there. So he's showing, at least in principle and in a very small example, that it's possible to replace brain function in a device. So unless you run into any hurdles that we currently don't know about where that wouldn't be possible, you can see how you can extend this beyond a small piece to an entire brain.
Excellent. So we're talking about one process or one piece.
Yeah.
But how is it possible to replicate what goes on in a specific person's mind, and also the whole implications of personality, which is a whole other area that would not...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess those are a number of different questions.
Yes,
I mean, one is about personality, and personality is often something that we talk about distinct from personal identity, or just slightly distinct, as in personality, often we think about characteristics, so we think about how does this person behave, how can we recognize that you are you from a second or third person perspective because you behave in a certain way. Then personal identity is something that seems more subjective, that is really inside of us, the sense of being, the sense of self-continuity, that we're aware, all of that sort of stuff is kind of tied into and wrapped in with personal identity. And I'm not exactly sure where you want to take this conversation, but again, I'll just repeat that to me, because I see all the evidence pointing to the brain being where all of this emerges as a phenomenon. So personal identity, personal characteristics, all of them are phenomena of brain activity, which means that everything that describes how that happens, everything that represents how these can emerge, is contained somewhere in the brain. And if you can capture those right parameters and functions, then you should be able to reproduce all of that.
Wow. So tell us about carboncopies.org and what exactly you're doing and how that's forwarding the possibility of substrate-independent minds.
Yeah, carboncopies.org is a nonprofit corporation, and it allows me, across different sources of funding, to continue in an unbroken chain to work on the big picture aspects of this field. Because it's a fairly new field and there isn't really another voice that ties it all together, it's useful to have a place where, first of all, we have a collection of basic literature that describes what's going on. We carry out outreach. We go to boards, people, and talk about this, just like I was giving the talk at the conference that you also attended. And most importantly, we track a roadmap that points out what are the goals, breaks down the goals into sets of problems, and from problems into possible solutions, and then tries to make this connection from all those possible solutions to the activity that's actually going on in terms of research, in terms of technology that's available, in terms of the experts that are in the field, and see that those are combined so that certain possible solutions are attempted. And hopefully multiple are done at the same time, because you don't want single points of failure in a plan for a project that is long-term and very complex. So one of the things that I'm really concerned about all the time is not to have single points of failure, either in terms of the technical solutions for problems, in terms of the people who can implement those technical solutions, so the labs and products that are available for that, or in terms of the resources, funding and material resources like infrastructure and technology that would be needed for these projects. So in all those places, I like to try to avoid single points of failure. So another aspect of my work, besides the road mapping, is a lot of networking, because I need to make sure that all of these connections are made and we haven't got a single point of failure, plus everything is covered. So everything being covered, a big thing that I've been doing in the past as well is identifying gaps. So things that need to be done, where requirements need to be met, but where currently nobody is doing it, or the work that's being done is simply not sufficient. And why? Is there a lack of interest because it's simply not clear why this is an interesting area to study, or is it because there isn't any funding for it, or is there some other reason why it doesn't work? So I've been doing that for a while, and in the last few years, I've managed to make a few things happen there, and so it's been good.
So Randall, as a neuroscientist, you have been doing product management to create the possibility of your product being a reality.
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say I enjoy doing it because for me, the most important thing is to see that we're getting towards this goal, that we're ultimately going to achieve substrate-independent mind. So for me personally, it's not as important to say, be the scientist with the best insight into how the AMPA receptor in certain synapses works or something like that. For me, it's more important to see where in this entire roadmap, what kind of activity can I best apply myself towards to move things along? And so that's why I enjoy doing big picture work, which is cross-disciplinary and means I need to understand enough about each one of those areas to dive in and to deal with the people that are there, even if I'm not a domain expert in just one particular spot.
Excellent. So our David, our tweeter, is referencing Old Man's War, which is a military science fiction and debut novel by John Scalzi, which came out in 2005. Are you familiar with it?
No, I'm not.
So, yes. So thank you. But in it, he references a brain pal, which is a neural implant that allows members of these defense forces to send and receive data, including speech, battle plans, and much more. They use their brain pals to translate alien languages, watch cartoons, read old books. David was making the reference to what you were talking about to this brain pal. So, David, he was not... the author is reading your work as opposed to...
Possible.
Yeah. So how much of, I do find that a lot of the people, involved in futurist thinking and in the community are big sci-fi fans readers. And I come to it from a practical point of view. I want to use technology to serve people and forward people. But it does come, a lot of their interest comes out of a fantasy world. How much of that motivates you or...
It certainly inspires. I like sci-fi. I maybe don't follow sci-fi as much as I might want to in the recent years, which is probably why I don't know that particular book. So my sci-fi experience, let's say the books that I've read, most of them are a bit older. It's back to Arthur C. Clarke and Asimov and all of that stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, because I just haven't had time to follow a lot of the new things that are coming out, although I keep hearing that you should read this, you should read that, da-da-da. I must say it did help me to conceptualize things. So, for example, when I started thinking about what is limiting us and how you could do something about that, at the same time as I was thinking about that, I also read a lot of sci-fi books, and I read Arthur C. Clarke's book, The City and the Stars. And in that book, which was written back in, I think, 1952 or so, he describes a world in which the citizens of a city can be dematerialized and exist inside a computer waiting there for thousands of years until it's their turn to come back and live another 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever the number of years were that they were their lifespans were at the time. So it treated everything as information, the buildings, the people, all of it. And that did have an impact on my thinking, because then I started thinking, oh, well, maybe that is a reasonable way of looking at things, that in the end, it's all patterns. It's all how things are put together and how they work. And given that my dad was a particle physicist, and that automatically to me made physics kind of a wonderful, beautiful, holy realm in which everything happens, I thought that that's how it had to be done. You needed to do it exactly as in the Arthur C. Clarke novel. You just treat everything as information and decompose all the atoms and put them all together again and stuff, which in the end seems like it's great. If we can do that at some point, that's fantastic, of course, but it's a little bit impractical. It's roundabout and difficult when you could just address the brain directly as being the most important aspect of this at the moment.
Excellent. So tell us more about cutting-edge neural interfaces. Where are we in terms of development? What will that do for neuroprosthesis in brain-machine interfaces and whole brain emulation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you look at the kinds of tools available, you were telling me before how you got a brain scan done, and probably it was an MRI or something similar, because those are the typical instruments used today to get a picture of what's going on all over the brain. But because it's treating the whole brain and you're doing it from the outside using imaging technology where you don't want to put so much power into the brain that you basically cook it, you get low resolution, which means that the MRI shows you only what's going on in big areas that contain thousands or millions of neurons in every pixel that it's showing you, as well as a low temporal resolution. It can only take a picture maybe one every second, which is too slow for neural processes. Neural processes happen about somewhere between 10 times per second to 1,000 times per second. That's the rate at which neurons can fire. So that's not enough to get a good idea of what's going on in the brain. If you want to interface with the brain at a more low level, if you want to get high-resolution information out, what we do right now is we put electrodes in the brain. Those are just basically long conductive needles that you can poke into the brain somewhere, and then you can read voltages from neurons. And right now, you can maybe put 100 or so into a brain and then get data out of it. That's used for things like the brain-machine interface called BrainGate that a patient uses to be able to control devices when he has no ability to control his arms or anything else like that. But that's still fairly primitive because those devices produce a very thin channel of communication with the brain. You can only read from a few neurons at a time. You can't get it from lots of different areas in the brain, but all of the interesting processes that go on in the brain involve cooperation between many different regions in the brain, so you need to get information from all of those. To do really interesting brain-machine interfaces, you don't want to just capture information through a thin channel coming out or just deal directly with, say, the visual or auditory systems, but instead you want to be able to put data that you otherwise don't have access to directly into the brain loop, or be able to get access to data that is inside the brain deep within the circuitry that you normally don't have access to. This means you need high resolution, large scale access. Preferably, and this is really the goal that is currently our goal, which is to get data from every single neuron in the piece of tissue you're interested in or in an entire brain at a rate of 1 millisecond sample rate, so 1,000 times per second. And that used to be way beyond what anyone was really striving for. But now, luckily, we have a group that I've been involved in seeing it come to be. I don't know exactly how much I contributed to that, but I know that I did get a few people in touch with this group. It's called POBAM. It's the Physics of Brain Activity Mapping group, and they are studying precisely that. So they've already produced a number of interesting white papers that look at which technologies can achieve that, where they bump into hurdles, what you would do to get around them, hybrid technologies you can create. And from that have come a number of prototypes. And just to mention a few quickly, so there is something called a molecular ticker tape, which is a biological approach to recording data from within every neuron. We can get into that in more detail if you're interested. Then there is the neural dust, which is an electronic way of using wireless free-floating, very tiny devices to record from hopefully every neuron in a brain. And there are a few others, such as arrays with very many electrodes, optoelectrodes actually, which are, okay, they can stimulate neurons as well optically and record from neurons, and they have flexible electrodes so that they can easily pass through various tissues in the brain. That's very interesting, but maybe not as far developed currently as the other two prototypes. But this is just the beginning. I mean, what we're seeing here is the start of something where I'd say, look, in 5 years, and you'll find advances that really get us to the cusp of being able to get information from every single neuron in vivo, live, from a large area of the brain, just like in the last 5 years, we've seen a huge amount of advance in being able to get the structure out of the brain. There was this whole field, connectomics, that emerged where now we can get three-dimensional reconstructions of brain right down to the level where you can see individual synapses.
How do you spell that?
Connectomics?
Yes.
It's C-O-N-N-E-C-T-I, and yeah, connect, sorry. Getting mixed up here, but it's like the connectome. Like you have the genome, but this is the connectome. So, yeah.
Okay. I want to make a note for future reference. Okay. As you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, artificial intelligence, where they're starting with the computer and they're trying to program a computer to act like a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're not even going there. You're bypassing that.
Yeah, it's very interesting, though, what they do. I mean, the art of artificial intelligence is really to abstract information about how the brain works. You try to observe what's going on, and sometimes it means using neuroscience to see what's going on in parts of the brain. The visual system has been mapped out pretty well, and artificial intelligence often goes to the visual system as an area to do their work. But then to take that and abstract it to as few functions as possible to represent how is it doing what it does. Now, that's interesting because to me, that's a good validation method. It's a good way to test when we're emulating something, is it producing similar results? Can it do this? And in any case, I'm interested to learn what's going on in the brain in the abstract sense to get a better understanding of what's going on there. But if you really want to create prosthetics, so if you want to do this not as something that applies just to machines, but that applies to individuals, if you want to be able to help people by building prostheses for their brain, then you need to be able to replicate exactly what's going on in their brain. And that's why emulation rather than an artificial intelligence simulation.
So what is Neuralink, your other startup?
Neuralink is an early stage startup that is about trying to accelerate the development of neural interfaces like the ones we were just briefly talking about. Not so much by picking one and deciding that that one is the winner, it's too early to do that, but by trying to offer an interface level, so an API, where if you are currently using this type of interface to do, a prosthetic retina to gather data from light and convert it into what the neurons want to see, then you can have a new type of interface, say these wireless free-floating interfaces, neural dust, collect that data, and you need to, again, still produce something that is usable by the brain. So you need to go through similar processes, and these similar processes, if we provide a basic infrastructure, a platform upon which they can all base what they're doing, then we can sit between the people who develop the interfaces and the people who develop the applications of what to do with those interfaces. And that goes from everything from EEG to these new types of wireless free-floating neural interfaces. And by being there like that, you make it easier for people to take their new device, test it somewhere, compare it with what others are doing, get into the market of applying it, and application developers for looking for the right kind of interface, getting the right sort of data that they want. It goes beyond just software, though. It goes into knowing which hardware needs to be bought or brought into in there to use it. So everyone needs amplifiers, for example. And which kind of people or experts are able to help them set up what they need to do or provide the solutions that they're looking for. So it's really a matter of combining an infrastructure in terms of an API with people and with known products and solutions in an attempt to make it more interesting and make the cost of entry into this field to get working in there lower, to get it make it easier for people to get started there.
So you're creating the ecosystem.
Yeah, I'm trying to make the ecosystem happen. But as I said, it's very early stage. Right now, the biggest thing we have going for us is that we already have all these contacts, all the connections to people who are building interfaces or who have currently companies working with interfaces that are either consumer application level, so we're mostly talking about EEG there, or medical. So in that case, it's mostly about implantables that are used to detect epileptic seizures or that are deep brain stimulation or things like that. And then research quality, so people who want to make very large arrays to record from mice and stuff like that.
So, I'm interested in where you get funding from.
Mm-hmm. Well, right now I have, it's private funding, so there are two major donors who are interested in this field. one of whom has already funded me in the past. I'm actually not at liberty to get into too much detail about this at the moment, but I can say that there's one who's been funding me in the past and one who I started working with recently who is also very interested in progressing the field. So I don't know how much more I can say about that at this moment, except to say that it's private funding, that I'm not currently at a lack of funding for this, so I'm not currently looking for funding, because it seems like if the plan is well constructed, if we know how to progress, then the money to make it happen is going to be there, which to me makes sense, because this is a field that is still pretty wide open, unlike, say, artificial intelligence, where you've seen all the big ones like Google and Facebook already jump on it. This is a field where there's more bio involved, but it's also directly applicable to us. It means something to us. We can immediately benefit from what comes out of this. So I think that as soon as somebody knows how best to enter it, then it becomes very valuable. So I'm not surprised that there are people who already say, yeah, if we can put this together, then I'll fund it. So yeah, private funding at the moment. And I just want to make one more note on that, which is that a reason why this is private funding and the reason why it's based on funders who already themselves have an interest in the field is twofold. One is that cross-disciplinary things like this currently aren't well-funded from academic sources, grants. Their grant structure is set up to mostly give money to things that are siloed very clearly within very specific domains. So it's difficult to do cross-disciplinary work there. On the other hand, a lot of the entrepreneurial investment capital that's out there is aimed at things where it's extremely easy to see that, say, revenue is going to be produced in 2 to 3 years or less. And it's hard to convince people that investment in something that is more long-term is very useful. So, in fact, we still see this as an issue. So part of the problem has been to break it down into little steps where at every step, say, within 2 to 5 years, you can see some revenue being made. But that's why the pool of investors available for it right now is still pretty small. But I think that as soon as we can show some success with this approach, then that's going to widen up very quickly.
Excellent. So what's up next for you if you have any free time, but what are your next milestones?
Well, so part of it is working on this Neuralink Corporation, of course. And the other is that it is time for a revamp of the roadmap. This happens very frequently. It's an iterative process. A good roadmap is one that is constantly being updated, not a static document. And right now, because in the past, the key focus has been on trying to get attention towards getting better functional data, that is data of activity in neurons, that has happened. Now there is, in fact, real attention being paid to that. There's a group, the POBAM group, there's the Brain Initiative, which kind of spawned from a proposal they made. And so it looks like, sure, that still needs attention, but not as much, not like a key missing piece, a gap that existed before. So it's time to identify what are the next areas that are most important to address. And I have a feeling that accelerating developments is going to be part of that. So getting more of a demand structure happening here, because as soon as you really need to implement things that many people want to use, they need to be much better than if you're just building a prototype for research, which you can then say, we've built this, we put it on a shelf, we use it for our experiments every once in a while, and we go on to a different topic. So I think that may be one of it. So revamping the roadmap is important. And then finally, there is a book that that I'm still in the process of finishing. It's called The Whole Brain Emulation Coffee Table Book. I mean, I could have started by writing the Whole Brain Emulation, science manual or something like that, but that seemed less useful to me, because people who are on the science side of it, they already know where they can find the papers for various details in there. And it was important to just collect the whole idea. The things that I talk about all the time in talks and that I'm talking to you now, make sure that they're all in one place and that they're accessible, which means that for every subtopic, you're going to have, say, one page of easily understandable, legible writing, and then an illustration that shows you what it's about. And it should go through all of the frequently asked questions, as well as the roadmap of how do we get from where we are to whole brain emulation, and what does substrate independent minds mean, why would you do it, all that sort of stuff. So that's going to be in that book.
So not only are you the founder, the CEO, the manager, the head researcher, you are also the evangelist.
I guess I'm also an evangelist. Although, you know, there you could say that Kurzweil is also an evangelist.
Oh, yes.
Because he says mind uploading will happen and things like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. So if people want to get involved with what you're doing, and a lot of people who listen to the show are people who want to get into different fields or managing products or startups, all across the board. So who are you looking for to help, and how can they get in touch with you?
So as I already pointed out, it's a very cross-disciplinary field. So in fact, it hardly matters what you can do. If you're interested in this, I'm sure there's a place where you can help, where you can do something, where you can get to work. You may even be able to build a career on it. And because one of the things I do is connect people, I mean, the networking is sort of finding solution people, problem people, the right kind of people for this kind of cross-disciplinary work. It's really something that I do all the time anyway. So I'm always happy to find new people interested. You can also help carboncopies.org out directly if you happen to have skills in things like website design or being able to write very well, to write copy, help make events happen, all that sort of stuff. So there are very basic things that organization requires. Then as soon as Neuralink starts moving ahead faster, when we really start expanding, then I'm sure there's going to be a need for people there, but that's too early right now. But certainly in the whole field, there's no lack of need for anyone. So if you're interested, the best thing to do is simply to contact me and tell me a little bit about your interest, a little bit about your background. And you can contact me. The easiest way is just go to carboncopies.org and you'll see my contact information right there. It's not difficult at all.
So we have a couple of other questions that have come in from tweeters, but I think it'll take more than a few minutes, so why don't we wrap up. I've been talking with Dr. Randall Koonin, who's a neuroscientist, neuroengineer, and founder, about the state of science and technology for neuroprosthesis. You can get in touch with him at by going to carboncopies.org, as well as Randall Koonin, RANDALKOENE.com. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
Well, just to thank you very much for having me on here. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you. And I realize that I put on a conference, the Startup Product Summit, which is like TED Talks about products. And I realized, well, the next thing we should talk about, hardware and future products.
That would be good. Yes. Yeah. Very interesting.
So, because as you were talking about funding on the inability for people to fund really long-term projects, products, even that's an issue that hardware has been having recently.
Yeah.
But
I mean, of course, I can understand it from the perspective of those investing, which is why I think part of what we need to get better at is to give those who want to create these kinds of long-term projects that involve hardware and stuff a better understanding of how to present their projects in a way that it makes it investable.
Excellent. Brilliant. So thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Thank you to our tweeters and listeners for hanging in with us during this time frame, as well as to BZ Lewis and Studio 132. The show will be available on demand. It goes out to iTunes. You can find it on Stitcher and on most, as well as we have an Android standalone app. Just search for PRODMGMTTALK in the Google Play Store. And you can go to startupproduct.com to follow the blog for upcoming events. And shout out to our new communities, Startup Product Meetup communities that have joined the Lean Startup Product Meetup in San Francisco. And shout out to our East Coast participants. I'll be in New York in May and look forward to the Women in Product Meetup in New York City. And have a great week. Thanks again.
Thank you,
Randall, for joining us.
sweet and sour at the same time. Mink and a porcupine, feeding ticket out of Valentine. Lost to a thief on a dry winter leaf. I